Welcome to Dads on the Air. We recently launched our newly designed website at dadsontheair.net. As part of the process of switching to the new site, the address to subscribe to our podcast has changed. If you downloaded this show manually from the website, you don't need to do anything. If you're subscribed to the Dads on the Air podcast via iTunes, you also don't have to do anything. However, if you're subscribed to this podcast using another method other than iTunes, you may have to resubscribe by clicking on the podcast link on the front page of our new website at dadsontheair.net. Thanks for your attention. Now here's this week's show.
We're dads on the air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air.
Well, welcome to Dads on the Air for the 21st of July, 2009. Beautiful winter morning here in Sydney. Clear skies, cold.
Bloody cold.
We are the world's longest running father's show, thanks to pure perseverance. Should be an interesting show this morning. We've got a couple of our regulars, Sue Price and the Men's Rights Agency, will come on talking about the lack of consultation over the moves to wind back what were very modest reforms by the previous government promoting cooperative and shared care after divorce. And the Labor government looks very much like they're going to wind it right back to the dark ages when more than half of all dads who went to the court rarely if ever saw their children again, and it was a really disgraceful situation, and this government appears to be hell-bent on taking us right straight back there. Unbelievable. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be also talking about with Michael Woods. There's been a spirited campaign by various feminist groups around the country campaigning outside the family courts claiming that the shared parenting laws or the shared parenting amendments forced children to spend time with abusive fathers, never abusive mothers, of course. And there's new statistics obtained under Freedom of Information which show very clearly that children are most at risk from their biological mothers, and that fathers are very much down the list of in terms of males who abuse children. And of course, it's usually the boyfriend is first on the list, and away you go. We'll also be talking with Neil Humphreys. He's the author of a new book, Be My Baby, a wonderfully entertaining man, Neil Humphreys, and he'll be talking about what happens when the new one comes along and just how scary it all is. And we'll be winding up the show talking with Benjamin Easton. Now, he's a very interesting character over in New Zealand, and he's in the mall in New Zealand as we speak, and he's very active over there.
Well, they've got a mall over there, do they?
Oh, they've got
not a rugby mall.
You're from New Zealand. You can talk.
Yes.
And so he will be talking about, he took the Bank of New Zealand to court claiming that their domestic violence campaign vilified men, and if you look at it, well, all men are abusers and all women are saints, and as the statistics clearly show, that is a lie. So we'll be talking with him about the vilification of men, and they all think that it's for a noble cause, which it most certainly isn't. And in the studio we have, after a long and sustained illness, he has emerged virtually from the dead.
And thank goodness for that. Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Phil York from Dads in Distress, and Ian Purdy after a magnificently flamboyant holiday in Vietnam.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everybody.
And myself, John Stapleton. So welcome to the show. First up, we have some news.
Indeed we do. From The Age, the headline reads, "Children eager to have their say on custody." They are innocent onlookers caught up in their parents' bitter conflict, but research suggests children of separating couples usually want to have some say in post-marital arrangements. They just don't want to be forced to choose between their parents. The extent to which children are involved in making decisions about where they live and how much time they spend with each parent depends to some extent on how much their parents allow it. But an Australian study suggests that although most children want to be part of the discussion, they concede that it puts them in a difficult position. Co-author of the study, Patrick Parkinson, who is a professor of family law at Sydney University, said it was important to listen to children's voices and to understand how they were experiencing the separation, but the ultimate decision should rest with the judges or the parents, not the child, he said. We were struck by how overwhelming the view of the kids were, that they wanted to have a say, but don't ask children to choose, but listen to their world. So this study has been published in the Journal of Family Matters and is based on 90 parents and 47 children and teenagers, the views of 20 family court judges and federal court magistrates, as well as lawyers, family consultants and mediators were also sought in this study.
So he's paid a great deal of attention to the industry. It's unfortunate Parkinson feels no obligation to come onto a community radio show like this. We've repeatedly asked him to come on the program, and despite the significant amounts of public money that he mops up in doing all these various studies, he does not feel any obligation to come on and explain his work or promote it. We're not a hostile, wouldn't be a hostile interview. It's really unfortunate that these sort of academics don't see it as part of their purlieu to actually explain what they do to the general public, the great unwashed. It's really unfortunate. Of course, the biggest problem in looking at that study and taking so much credence of the family law industry is that the family reports on which this is based are, as we've repeatedly maintained over many years, utterly biased and utterly corrupt, and anyone who's ever been through the process will know all the standard tricks that they use. A standard little trick, for instance, is you go in there with your kids, dad and the kids, and the psych will go, "Now tell us what mummy wanted." And that is then seen as what the kids want. Really sort of nasty little tricks that they play all the time, and so you're just filtering their views through one of the most corrupt processes in you'll ever see.
Yeah, it is very difficult. And one of the major complaints I get from the dads that attend our groups is that it always seems to be the mother that goes in first. So the mother gets this couple of hour session with this professional. She goes in there, bags the hell out of him, and then as soon as he comes in second, he's on the back foot straight away.
And the kids are really stirred up by that stage, and really grotesque. And the dirty little secret of family law is that the entire future of these children, the entire fate of their lives, is all built around a one-hour interview with a psych. And any common sense will tell you that an hour interview with a psych is no evidence at all.
Sad, sad stuff.
And, of course, the same family court uses the same bunch of psychs often as used by the Department of Community Services, which, of course, is in complete disrepute in this state.
Yep.
And that's no accident either.
All this does is just reinforce the view that I've stated for a long time, that you should never, ever, under any circumstances, allow yourself to be dragged kicking or screaming or otherwise into the family court at all. You should do the deal with your soon-to-be ex-wife before you leave the family home while you still have rights. Do a deal, get it in writing, get it signed by JPs and lawyers and anybody else, the Queen if you need to, get it locked in concrete, and then leave, and never, ever, ever under any circumstances set foot inside the family court and allow a bunch of lawyers, psychologists, judges, etc., 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 to basically dictate how your life and your family life is to be led.
Bottom feeders, they're called.
Indeed. Next story is from the yesterday's Daily Telegraph, and the headline reads, "Single women ditch men for dogs." Excuse me. Women choose dogs over men because they're apparently more reliable and provide a sense of security. They used to be man's best friend, but now it's single women whose lives have gone to the dogs. Australia's single women are turning their backs on men and opting for a much loyal and reliable companion, a dog. In the past year, 60% of new business has come from young single women, Sydney pet care owner Richard Durant said. It's a growing trend I've noticed over the last few years. These women who live busy lives, they want company when they get home, and in many cases you'll find the dog sleeps in their bedroom and even in the bed with them. The fastest growing segment of dog owners in the inner city is young single women, and it's almost like a child substitute. I guess, you know, for single women, it says here that it's owning a dog increases their feeling of safety and security. I can certainly see that, but, you know.
Moving right along.
Be more 2009. Thank you.
Okay, well, here's an article in last Thursday's Telegraph under the heading Men? Who needs them? Scientists create test tube Frankensperm. Kate Sikora has written, men could lose their role in the reproductive process after human sperm was created artificially in a laboratory. Scientists used stem cell technology to grow the sperm in a groundbreaking experiment that offers hope of fatherhood to thousands of infertile men. In a process many experts believed was still decades away, scientists in Britain treated the stem cells with a cocktail of chemicals. They then watched as the cells grew heads and tails. But the controversial work has yet to be proven successful in producing healthy babies, and also raises moral questions with the possibilities that babies could be born entirely through artificial means. So here is the first step in basically excluding men from the entire reproductive process. I wrote a book a few years ago called Splatterpuss, where I talked about the Third World War. You can find it on my website, ianpurdy.com.
What a shameless self-promoter you really are.
Yeah, shameless self-promotions. Right. Well, look, moving right along, there's a study being conducted by the University of Pennsylvania, Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfers. They called it The Paradox of Declining Female Happiness. The abstract states, by many objective measures, the lives of women in the United States have improved over the past 35 years, yet we show that measures of subjective well-being indicate that women's happiness has declined both absolutely and relative to men. The paradox of women's declining relative well-being is found across various data sets, measures of subjective well-being, and is pervasive across demographic groups and industrialized countries. Relative declines in female happiness have eroded a gender gap in happiness, in which women in the 1970s typically reported higher subjective well-being than did men. These declines have continued, and a new gender gap is emerging, one with higher subjective well-being for men. And hey, we're not actually that happy either. Let's face
it's interesting,
it.
Interesting, though, isn't it? Despite everything, the blokes are happier.
Yeah, that's amazing. But I mean, it sounds like we're all less happier. I mean, we've got all this amazing technology, and you know, we can, you know, be anywhere in the world and have the, you know, news reported instantly, and all these advantages of technology and new cars and wonderful things and inventions and leisure-saving devices, and yet we are all across the board a lot less happy than we used to be.
We'll be back after a short break. We'll be talking with Neil Humphreys. He's the author of a new book, Be My Baby. We'll be back.
Disregard. grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And our next guest, who we hope will never be a separated dad, is Neil Humphreys, author of a new book, Be My Baby. You there, Neil?
I am. Good morning. How are you going?
Yeah, we're great. It's a beautiful spring morning here, which I assume it also is in Geelong,
it's
hey?
It's a lovely day. Yeah, it's a lovely warm day.
Good-o. Now, look, you're a quite an interesting character, aren't you? You've managed to carve out a living out of freelance writing. You do a couple of different father's columns for different magazines. Can you just explain what you do?
I do. I mean, I left England when I was 21 because my mother basically kicked me out of the house and told me to see the world. So I ended up in Singapore, where I somehow ended up writing three bestsellers there, three kind of Bill Bryson-type travel humour books. And then the government got
and
up
And what
there.
Were they called?
They were called... Now, this is a very original title. The first one was called Notes from an Even Smaller Island, which rips off Bill Bryson's Notes from a Small Island about Britain. And he still hasn't sued me yet, which I'm very disappointed about because I wanted to meet him in court for his autograph. So I wrote three best-selling books there. And then I came to Australia, still freelance writing for both Singapore and Australia. And then my wife and I decided we'd start a family. And I started to look around for books from a father's perspective about pregnancy because I was pretty clueless. I mean, I was extremely clueless about the whole thing, as many first-time fathers are.
Yeah, of course.
And I just couldn't find that many books. I mean, there were one or two, but there just wasn't that many that just told it how it is from a father's perspective, a first-time father's perspective, who, you know, you could be the most intelligent guy in the world, but we're all pretty clueless about it, really. It's a real step into the unknown. And, like, when we went to our doctor... When my wife was first pregnant, he said, you're going to have to see an obstetrician. And my wife was saying, oh, yeah, obstetrician. And he said, yeah, get yourselves a good obstetrician. And I just wanted to put my hand up and say, will someone please tell me what the hell's an obstetrician? I had no idea. I thought it was something to do with NASA. I'm like, what the hell do we need an astronaut for? People laugh now. Of course I know what an obstetrician is now. But I just had no clue. You know, and I think a lot of guys are... you know, they just don't want to admit that they're pretty clueless. So that's what Be My Baby's about. It's about a clueless guy who's basically trying to sort of find his way, feel his way around towards becoming a father. It's not a textbook. It doesn't pretend to know all the answers, but it does suggest that first-time dads out there, don't be afraid. You're not the only one who are in this position, you know. We've all been there.
And did it seem that nobody paid you much attention, that all the attention was on your beloved wife?
Absolutely. That is a fantastic point. I mean, that is absolutely true. It was all about my wife, and God love her. I mean, she was magnificent, don't get me wrong, throughout the pregnancy. But, yeah, you do kind of get overlooked, and you do want to be involved. And, you know, people always ask my wife the questions, you know, how are you feeling? What names have you got picked out for the baby? You know, what sex do you want to have for the baby? And things like that. Whereas I was kind of, you've done your bit, you've provided the sperm, well done.
Yeah.
Smoke your cigars, and let's see you again in 9 months. I mean, even with my wife's parents, they considered my job done. It was bizarre because...
You became a more deeper irrelevancy than ever, right?
Yeah, well, beforehand, you know, before we got married, that's my wife, Tracy, her parents were typical, you don't go near each other. You know, you sleep on the couch and my wife will sleep upstairs and blah, blah, blah. The second we put that wedding ring on our fingers, they were forcing us almost at gunpoint to have sex at every opportunity so we could give them grandchildren. It was the most bizarre experience ever. And then once you've done that, once you've said yes, I'm not a territorial army sergeant. I'm not firing blanks. And they're all ecstatic and they say, well done. And then it's almost job done. Over, finished. See you again in 9 months. Very, very bizarre, you know?
I can imagine. And so what was the process of writing this book then? What was it all about?
I kept a diary at first. And it literally starts, the very first lines of the book, the very first words of the book are two lines. Because that's the two lines popping up in the pregnancy test box, you know, in the contraption that my wife very romantically peed on. I mean, that's the very first words of the book, two lines. And then I even talk about...
I don't actually understand that, having never had anything to do with a pregnancy test kit. What, there's a couple of lines on them or something that change colour or something?
Well, even that, I was very self-conscious because, you know, I went to the supermarket and I do not know why I did this. You know, maybe other first-time fathers are in the same position. I felt embarrassed buying the pregnancy test. I felt like I was a teenager all over again, buying condoms. It was the strangest thing. I was hiding... When I was a kid, you know, when you was a young adult, you never bought condoms in front of people. You know, you always hid them or put them under bread or whatever. And it was the same with the pregnancy test. I was buying extra long chocolate Toblerone bars just to cover the pregnancy test in the basket. It was surreal, and I don't know why I behaved that way. So anyway, we got the thing home, and you read the instructions, and basically, it's not romantic. Your wife pees on a stick, and then you put the thing on the top of the toilet, and me being me, not having read the instructions properly, I just said, oh, look, there's two lines in the pregnancy test. Of course, not knowing that actually meant it was positive. And my wife jumps up, which was a bit embarrassing because she still had the trousers around the ankles, so she was doing her penguin impression around the toilet, waddling from side to side. I'm still not entirely sure what's going on. She's almost in tears. And that was the start of our journey, you know, and that's where the book begins.
And so was she wobbling around in excitement and happy or...
Yeah, it was a combination delight, shock, anger, because I didn't read the contraption properly. Right. It was a combination of everything, and that's how it started. And then from there, I just compiled this diary and just took note of some of the funny things and bizarre things and unusual things that you see during the pregnancy process. I mean, it's just very bizarre. I mean, little things like my wife becoming public property. As soon as a woman is pregnant, it's like there's a license to touch her, you know, and she doesn't necessarily want to be touched by random strangers, you know, and they mean well, but before you know it, they're patting her stomach and rubbing her belly and things like that. People we barely know, you know, people we occasionally see in the street are suddenly molesting my wife, you know, with all the right intentions, but just little things like that. And then you've got the social taboos, which I'm fascinated with, you know, when my wife... You know, sort of 3-4 months in, like with many pregnant women, you watch other people's reactions because they're all thinking the same thing. You want to say congratulations, but you're not entirely sure she's pregnant. So you can see this dilemma in her head. Is it pregnant or is it fat? Pregnant, fat, pregnant, fat.
Oh, I know. I've done that.
And you don't want to get it wrong. I've done it wrong. And I've done it as well. Ooh. In fact, a dear friend of mine back in Singapore, I said to her, you know, you're looking very well. When is the baby due? And she said, I had it 3 months ago. And then when you're in those situations, what do? You know, you just wish the ground would swallow you up.
Yeah, I know. And of course, it's so significant to them, you know, whether or not they've got a bit of extra weight or not. It's the worst thing you can possibly say.
I absolutely love the social taboos that sort of change when you become pregnant and your wife. I find it absolutely fascinating. So I just took stock and took note of some of these things and just wrote them down, you know.
So what gave you the confidence to do all this? Was it the fact that you've cobbled together this career as a freelance writer that...
Well, it's a combination of factors. I mean, that's one of them, yes. I'd written books before, so I knew roughly how to write books and things like that. The second thing was, I think the more interesting thing is, I'm a product of a broken home myself. I mean, I don't want to get the violins out or anything. It was a perfectly happy childhood. But my parents divorced when I was only 4 years old. So I was raised exclusively by women, something that I now look back on and I was with fond memories. But the fact of the matter was I had the classic once-a-week father, sometimes once-a-fortnight father. So I was paranoid, obsessed even, from the very earliest age of when I understood the concept of fatherhood and what it meant to be a father and to try and be as good a father as I could possibly be from the moment my wife becomes pregnant and then every day subsequently. So I was kind of obsessed with fatherhood, what it meant, what it represented, what I should try to do, and just trying to do the right thing. I mean, the book is essentially a young guy, pretty clueless, but he's driven by a real obsession to try and do the right thing, because I'm very conscious of the fact that my father wasn't around through no fault of his or my mother's own, but that he wasn't around. So I was conscious of the fact of trying to just do the right thing.
All right, we're talking with Neil Humphreys. He's the author of a new book, Be My Baby, already selling well. We'll be back in a moment.
The day my boy was born was the best day of my life. I went to the hospital with my pregnant wife. She gave me a son. She filled my world with joy, the greatest feeling I ever felt was when I first held my boy. He's my boy, and I'm his daddy. I love him forever, I love him madly. Yeah, he's my boy, my pride and joy. Nothing can compare with holding his hand and running my fingers through his hair. Take him walking, I love to see him laugh. I love to hear him singing when he's in the bath. I love to take him places, I love his childish ways. 'Cause he's my boy, my pride and joy. What more can I say? Sometimes he annoys me, sometimes I get upset, but that doesn't last for long. There's nothing I regret. He fills my life with sunshine that never goes away. 'Cause he's my boy, every hour of every day. Yeah, he's my boy, and I'm his daddy. I love him forever, I love him madly. Yeah, he's my boy, my pride and joy. Nothing can compare with holding his hand and running my fingers through his hair. Every breath I take is a celebration of his life. When I'm with him, it feels to me like I'm in paradise. There's nothing could be better. He is a perfect child. He breaks the rules, he calls me a fool. Then he turns and smiles. 'Cause he's my boy, and I'm his daddy. I love him forever, I love him madly. Yeah, he's my boy, my pride and joy. Nothing can compare with holding his hand and running my fingers through his hair.
Grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the air.
We're talking with Neil Humphreys. He's the author of a new book, Be My Baby. There, Neil.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Now, just take us through what happened. First of all, though, I gather this book is actually selling quite well.
It is, thanks. Yeah, it's doing very well. We, because I'm originally from Singapore, you know, we launched it in Singapore in Southeast Asia, and it became an international bestseller, which I'm very flattered about. And I'm told it's actually the first book ever from Geelong. No surprises there, I'm sure, to become an international bestseller, because in Geelong, unless you write a book about, you know, Gary Ablett, it's not really going to do that well. So, yeah, it's the first book from regional Victoria to become an international bestseller. And it's now doing the rounds quite well around Australia. It's out nationwide now, doing particularly well in Sydney and New South Wales. So very delighted about that, very flattered.
And if you want a copy, you can get it where?
Any good bookstore, or you can get it online from any of your bookstores. Everyone from Angus and Robertson, Borders, Dimmocks, you know, all the decent bookstores will have it.
So Neil Humphreys, the obvious spelling, Be My Baby. And there's also neilhumphreys.net.
There is.
Of course.
If you're really desperate, yeah.
Really desperate. Okay, just take us through it. So, you know, the pregnancy test shows up positive, and then how was the nine-month pregnancy?
Well, as I say, the first thing is, and this is a cliche, I'm sure you've heard it many times, but I think your admiration for your partner goes through the roof. I mean, if it doesn't, there has to be something wrong with you. I mean, the pain that she went through, first the first trimester, which is the most painful trimester, the constant vomiting and everything, and then, of course, the birth itself, was just absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the respect I have for my wife and any woman who gives birth is just an extraordinary thing. And then when I think about, I also say in the book that we're very spoiled now. You know, I call it the Oprah Winfrey, Dr. Phil generation. I mean, it's great that we're so hands-on and all the rest of it, but my mother, to give birth to me, actually went to hospital on a bus on her own and didn't have any ultrasounds or anything like that. You know, in those days, it was a kind of, yeah, don't smoke too much and don't drink too much Guinness and we'll see you at the birth. I mean, that was pretty much it. So it was kind of a constant juggling act, because on the one hand, you want the absolute best for your wife and child, but my very working class sensibilities was like, geez, we're really pampered now, you know.
Yeah.
So it's that thing. But yeah, I was absolutely impressed with my wife throughout, and she had to be strong because, and I'm sure every father and mother will relate to this, the horror stories that you hear during pregnancy. I don't know why people do this. They don't seem to do anything else. You know, you don't take a driving test, and then someone a day before says, oh, on my driving test, you know, I smashed into the back of a truck. You know, you just don't hear that. But with with pregnancy, it's all the horror stories. No matter what you say, your first bath. When I had the first bath, I dropped the baby on its head and it nearly drowned. And, oh, yeah, I remember the time I left my baby on the freeway and things like that. And I remember the time when my baby got kidnapped by aliens. And everyone has a horror story on any subject. Yeah. So it's very hard to keep your sanity. And then we're talking. And the other thing is, my wife, God bless her, names. Names is a big deal, and I've mentioned it in the book. Of course, you spend a lot of time discussing names.
Of course.
And it's a very important thing, obviously. But everybody knows someone with a name that kind of puts you off that name, you know, which is why no one in Germany will ever be called Adolf, for obvious reasons.
Yes.
So the trouble is, my wife is a teacher. So there is not a name in the English language.
She doesn't have a negative connotation.
It was a monster.
Yes.
So you can go through the list. You know, oh, what about Billy? Oh, I can't have Billy. He used to eat chalk. Oh, what about Josephine? No, she tried to eat the hamster. You know, and it goes on and on and on. We must have went through 50 names before we actually found someone who wasn't the young Adolf Hitler in our classroom. So, you know, you go through all these things.
And the name was?
And the name was Abbey Rose.
Oh.
Abbey Rose, because we're big Beatles fans, and it sounds a little bit like Abbey Road.
Yeah.
And we couldn't get Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band on the birth certificate. So we went with Abbey Rose, girl Abbey Rose.
Great.
And she is great. And that's the other thing you get paranoid about, because, and you've seen this, I'm sure you've seen this, when you see parents and they're just so biased towards their child, and you say, you don't want to be like that. You want to be objective. If your child is a little brat, you want to say she's a little brat, and so on and so on. And you know, you see these parents and they say, oh, you know, look at my child, she's so perfect, you must see my child. And then they bring little Igor out from the dungeon, you know, and little Quasimodo comes crawling towards you.
Yeah, that's
and they're like,
horror
isn't
show.
He adorable? You know, as he starts eating your fingers one by one and spitting them out, and they've got a leash on his neck, and he, you know, so he doesn't bite the neighbours and things like that. And you think, I hope that doesn't become me. And then, of course, the second your baby comes into the world, of course it becomes you.
Yes.
She's the greatest human being in the history of mankind, and I'll kill anybody who says otherwise. You know, that's the initial paternal reaction, and it's one that stays with you. And it started the moment she came out of the birth. In fact, the birth was so surreal, and because I was there all the way through.
Take us through it, yeah.
So surreal because, firstly, my wife, as I mentioned just now, was in tremendous pain. She's a very small person. And didn't get much bigger during the pregnancy. So she really was trying to push out this baby for a very, very small area, a very contracted area. So she was in tremendous pain. Tremendous pain. She still went for the natural birth, but she nearly passed out from the pain, so we went for the epidural. So we had this, and my wife is crying, and I'm nervous, and I'm pacing the floor. And so this lovely, chirpy Victorian anaesthetist, if I've said it right, came into the room. And to try and relax us, but it seemed to be the wrong context, the wrong time. He discovered that we were British, and he said, oh, I love England, you know, I love the history and the heritage. So there's my naked wife screaming, I'm pacing the floor, and he's trying to tell me about the architectural splendour of the Tower of London. It's very hard to take this all on board. My wife is crying, he's trying to put a needle in her back, and he's telling me why he loves Jeremy Clarkson so much from Top Gear. It's a very, very surreal situation. I'm like, yes, I love Jeremy Clarkson.
Very profound, though, isn't it, the whole thing?
Sorry?
Very profound, though.
Oh, very profound, because after that, my wife, the epidural worked, and my wife was very relaxed. And then when she's dilated 10 centimetres and the baby starts to come out, You move, you sort of drift away from your own subconscious. It was, I mentioned in the book, it was like I was floating above myself. Sounds a bit pretentious, but that's how I felt. You know, I was floating above myself and looking down at the room and looking down at all the proceedings. It took on a surreal quality, something I've never experienced before or since. When my little baby girl's head started to appear, I started talking absolute gibberish. Because I was in a state of shock. My wife was saying, what is it? What is it? What is it? And for some strange reason, I just started saying, when I was young and we had a dog, and I used to go to this butcher, and I used to get tripe. And tripe, you know, is all the odds and ends of various animals put together. It's all grey and gristly and pretty much very, very ugly. I said, that's exactly how our baby's head looks like. It looks like a big plate of dog's tripe. And she's like, what are you saying? What's wrong with our child? Is it deformed? Is it this? Is that? Of course, it was none of those things, but it was like being intoxicated. It was like being just high, surreal. It was just a whole nother level. And then the baby came out, Abby Rose came out, and the doctor, the obstetrician, asked me to cut the cord. And to this day, I'm surprised I didn't cut the baby's leg off, you know, because I was shaking, I was nervous, I still wasn't quite on this planet. So I managed to cut the cord, and then he handed me the child, my child, my daughter. But of course, she nearly shot off my hand like a bullet from a gun, because, you know, they're covered in that slippery vernix, it's called, that slippery goo that's all around the baby's body as they come out. And she just nearly shot off my hand like a bowling ball down a bowling alley. I mean, I nearly had to literally leap across and catch her like a goalkeeper. And it was the most wondrous experience of my life, and I would, if it is possible, I would recommend every single father to be, please, if you can, you know, make the time to try and be there at the birth, because it's an experience you'll never get again, you know.
That's true. Look, we're running out of time, so how old is she now?
She is now 13 months.
Yeah.
And she's doing her drunk walk at the moment. She is that
just
drunk
walking
in the middle of Sydney town centre. You've all seen him. He's that guy who spends all his energy trying to walk but doesn't actually go anywhere. And he gets very angry that the scenery around him doesn't change, so he starts moaning at himself. Well, she's the same. She's got a left leg that turns to stone, but her right leg turns into Michael Flatley.
Very sweet.
And
all
does
right.
The Irish jig, and she is a little star. She's working on the drunk walk.
Right. So just any final comments on the whole experience of becoming a dad?
I would just say, in all seriousness, try to be there every step of the journey. I know we all have to work, we all have to earn a living, and that's to be expected, but if you can, try to be with your wife or your partner for as much of the 9 months of the journey as you possibly can, because it is a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and it is truly something that will stay with you forever.
We've been talking with Neil Humphreys. He's the author of a new book, Be My Baby. You can see more of that at the website neilhumphreys.net or buy the book at any good bookshop. Geelong's only international bestseller, Be My Baby. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that was Neil Humphreys, Be My Baby. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back. Next on the line, we have Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. How are you, Sue?
Good morning, Phil. Good.
That's good. Sue, last week you've put through a press release, and it reads, Men's Right, No Fault Divorce Should Be Properly Reviewed. Important policy review slams the door on men's and fathers' groups. I'll just take a moment just to read a bit to let our listeners know.
Yeah, fine.
It says, the Australian Institute of Family Studies is currently undertaking research into the effects of important changes into family law, which in 2006 introduced shared parental responsibility and focused on a child's right to be raised by both parents. The Attorney General says he will be guided by the report from the Australian Institute of Family Studies, which disturbingly is only taking submissions submissions from a select and anointed group of organisations rather than the broader community. From a father's perspective, no-fault divorce has been singularly unattractive. 70% of separations are initiated by women, and at least 75% of fathers seeking assistance from your organisation, the Men's Right Agency, report their wives are engaging in affairs, often started on the internet, have serious problems including abuse of alcohol and drugs, mental health issues, gambling, violence towards their family, and a total disregard for any promises made for a long-term commitment to each other and their children. You say in your press release that the federal MP Tony Abbott has raised a proposal for fault to be reintroduced back into the family law proceedings with an expectation of a number of divorcing couples might reduce and warring parents would stay together to help a little counselling sort out their problems. So it's a very very well set out press release, and I've got to say, Sue, I agree with you.
Well, I think a lot of people do, Phil. One of the problems that we have is we need to have this discussion. Obviously, the family law as it is, as it's structured now, doesn't work to the satisfaction of the parents or for the children. And we really do need to be asking ourselves, how do we reduce the level of divorce? How do we get more commitment from parents when they have children to trying to make their marriage work instead of walking away from the first sign of trouble? And secondly, how do we stop the unabated attack on perfectly good parents with the use of false allegations? Because that's what's keeping a lot of parents out of children's lives. Those parents happen to be mostly fathers.
Yep, absolutely. And
so we've got the two issues. So where do we go with it? Do we bring the debate back to, do we start talking about fault? I think it's not human nature to let people off the hook without having some sort of attribution of fault made onto that person who's been the one who's in the wrong, and I think it's a perfectly sensible argument.
Indeed, and I tend to agree with you. And as you state here, 70% of separations are actually initiated by women.
You can ask yourself, why is that? Why does it look so much greener for them on the other side? Why do they want to have a divorce? Because our social policies encourage it, in actual fact. They know that if they leave their husband, they can actually be financially better off than when if they remained in the marriage, with all the payments that they're entitled to get, which a lot of people forget include, high levels of child support, parenting payments, family tax benefit payments, rent assistance, all these different payments that they can get. Often means they've got more disposable income available to them as a single mother with their children rather than remaining in the marriage.
And there's also the happily ever after idea that is foisted on people, and when they do find that their marriage is not the bed of roses that they were expecting it to be, that because of the situation which makes it actually easy to leave, that they are opting to leave, and of course all their girlfriends are doing the same thing, and they all talk about it in the cafe and what they're going to get, and the poor bloke is, he's at work. Men don't tend to plan for divorce as much as women do.
Well, they don't at all, Phil. That comes like a bolt out of the blue to them, most of them, and mums have plenty of time to plan and plot and scheme, unfortunately. One of the better ones we heard about was a woman who spent 3 years. She decided she wanted to get through her accountancy degree first, before she actually stitched Dad up with the finances, and then finally decided she was leaving. The tragedy in her situation was the eldest boy, who couldn't cope with the parents' separation, actually shot himself. So this is what is being brought about by people who are unthinking, uncaring, and who have absolutely no sense of commitment or responsibility to each other.
Makes it very difficult. Now, in regards to the Australian Institute of Family Studies, they're apparently asking for feedback.
No, they're not. That's the Law Council. That's John Wade as chair of the Law Council. I think either trying to mitigate the problem that the Australian Institute of Family Studies don't actually take any any submissions from other people being non-government funded organisations or individuals who have a stakeholder type interest in what goes on in family law and divorce. So Australian Institute of Family Studies are restricted in the people they will talk to. They know they will talk to the people that they've developed that have similar views, so they're not going to expand their views into the wider community. They won't be asking for a submission from us. I had a conversation with Laurie Maloney after great difficulty, three emails, finally produced a response, a verbal response from him to say no, they wouldn't be seeking outside submissions. And when I asked him to put this information in writing, he categorically refused.
But yet on the website for the Australian Family Institute of Family Studies, they've got they say that there's three parts of evaluating the reforms.
That's from the Attorney General's website of the guidelines for the commissioning of the study. Yes, that's right.
But yet they're not involving us.
But they're not involving us as far as that. Well, according to Laurie Maloney, if anyone else can tell me anything different, I'd be grateful to hear about it. The only reason this came up was because the Attorney General, when I met with them a fortnight ago, suggested that we might like to have some input into the decision, into the recommendations that were being made, which of course we agreed, and I attempted to do so, only to be told we're not welcome.
And finally, so what advantages do you see of introducing a fault, fault back into a divorce procedure? I mean, how is that going to help?
Well, I'm not so sure whether the fault needs to be introduced into, who betrayed the relationship, who did this or who did what. But certainly when you come to the distribution of where the children are going to live and when you come to looking at property settlements, this is where you need to be deciding, have those parents honoured their marriage? Have they honoured their commitment to their children? Are they going to be a good person to bring up those children? And instead of the courts taking the one-eyed view that they do currently, which is to believe everything that mum says, rather than looking at the complaints that the father may raise, then we need to be taking that a step further. We need to be saying, is it dad or is it mum who's going to make the better parent here?
But yet they still call it a fairer system.
Well, we don't have a fair system because...
No, indeed, we don't.
There's this manifest, overwhelming maternal preference which still exists in the community, even though it doesn't matter what dad does today. He can do all the housework, he can go out to work, he can do all the rest of it. Someone, somewhere, will still find fault with him.
Of course. No fault divorce meant all the fault was the blokes.
That's right, John. Absolutely. It is John I'm talking to, isn't it?
Yeah, that's me.
That's right. That's exactly what's happened. And I think we've got to stand up. Well, I am heartily sick of it. After 15 years of doing what we do, I have had enough of listening to the garbage that comes out, and we need to put this right.
Well, it's a snow job by the mandarins, obviously.
Well, are we going to let them get away with it?
Well, they're getting away with it as we speak.
Well, are we going to let them continue to get away with it, or are we all going to speak up and say, that's enough, we've had enough?
We're talking with Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency. She's a regular guest on Dad's on the Air. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and the answer to your question... we'll
there
have to leave hanging.
No,
it's blowing in the wind.
Let them get away with it, okay?
We'll be back. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks,
it was good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
We'll be back.
Disappoint you or let you down? Should I be feeling guilty or let the judges frown? 'Cause I saw the end before we'd begun. Yes, I saw you were blind and I knew I had won. So I took what's mine by eternal right. Took your soul out into the night. It may be over, but it won't stop there. I am here for you, if you'd only care. You touched my heart, you touched my soul, changed my life and all my goals. and love is blind, and that I knew when my heart was blinded by. You have kissed your lips and held your head, shared your dreams and shared your bed. I know you well, I know your smell, I've been addicted to you. Goodbye, my lover, goodbye, my friend. You have been the one, you have been the one for me. Goodbye, my lover, goodbye, my friend. You have been the one, you have been the one for me. I am a dreamer, and when I wake, you can't break my spirit. It's my dreams you take. And as you move on, remember me, remember us and all we used to be. I've seen you cry, I've seen you smile, I've watched you sleeping for a while. I'd be the father of your child, I'd spend a lifetime with you. I know your fears and you know mine. We've had our doubts, but now we're fine. And I love you, I swear that's true. I cannot live without you. Goodbye, my lover, goodbye, my friend. You have been the one, you have been the one for me. Goodbye, my lover, goodbye, my friend. You have been the one, you have been the one for me. And I still hold your hand in mine when I'm asleep. And I will bear my soul in time when I'm kneeling at your feet. Goodbye, my lover, goodbye, my friend. You have been the one.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
We have Michael Woods from the Men's Health and Information Resource Centre at the University of Sydney on the line. You there, Michael?
Yes, John.
Great. Look, thanks very much for coming on to Dads on the Air again.
Now, a pleasure indeed.
Now, there's new data out from the Department of Child Protection in Western Australia, which debunks the myth about all the violent dads. Can you outline for our listeners what it's all about?
Yes, well, I mean, you don't usually get access to this data. It's usually sort of concealed, but Western Australia has released a breakdown of the gender of the perpetrators of child abuse, and it's quite timely given the review being undertaken by the AIFS around the shared parenting provisions. One of the very spurious claims that's often made, as you know, John, is that children must stay with their mums because there's greater risk of maltreatment at the hands of their dads, that somehow mums are the appropriate primary caregiver, and shared parenting is inappropriate because kids are going to be at more risk.
Yeah.
But in fact, the data from Western Australia shows, looking at the child abuse that has occurred in Western Australia in the past few years, that the vast majority of cases of child abuse where the child abuse occurred from a parent, the abuse has actually been the mother rather than the father. The father, in fact, looking at the data, is probably the safest person of all for a child to be with. There's more abuse occurs from those outside the families, all forms of abuse, but within the families, the mothers certainly, the cases of neglect, the mothers, over 90% of the cases, the mother was the major perpetrator identified there, with emotional and psychological abuse of children. Over twice as many mothers as natural fathers were perpetrators of abuse. With physical abuse, slightly more mothers, not as high, but there's slightly more mothers than fathers where there are substantiations. These aren't just allegations. These are where cases have been found. With sexual abuse, it's the only one that's different. There's more fathers are likely to have sexual abuse. 13% of cases of sexual abuse, they did involve the mother. within the family. So it's not the, you know, the old sort of stereotypes, I guess, that we, well, not we, but a lot of people do operate with, is that sexual abuse is something that men do to children. In fact, you know, this data clearly shows that, as I said, 13% of cases where family is involved in abusing the child, the mother's actually the perpetrator.
Right, and what fascinated me was that a lot of this data had to be obtained under freedom of information laws. Can you just explain why?
Yes, look, well, John, look, the last time any kind of gender breakdown was readily available around child abuse figures in Australia that I can find anyway, maybe I've overlooked something, but I've looked pretty hard, 1996, and Adam Thomason released some data which suggested between 68 and 75% of perpetrators of abuse were females, and that's probably the same today. I don't think there's much difference. But since 1996, there's been a particular coyness on the part of government departments to actually break down the gender of perpetrators, which seems really odd. I mean, obviously, child protection, the well-being of the children is the focus of what all this is about, and that's fine. But one would think that having some profiling of the nature of perpetrators would be important for, you know, better protecting children. So it seems very, very odd indeed that this is something which has been avoided. I hate to engage in conspiracy theories, I do, but it does seem that as we've been developing ideas about, you know, victimology for women around a lot of the family law issues that have occurred, that women are always portrayed as victims, this became problematic, having this data that showed, in fact, women aren't the victims. This is a case where there's a clear discrepancy of power between an adult and a child, and in fact we find that it's women are more likely to abuse that position of power than a male.
So it's been quite systematic, really, this concealing of the evidence.
Look, I don't know what their motives are, but it does seem very strange to me, John. And certainly in America, the child maltreatment statistics, which are released annually in the United States, they've never been so coy about these things at all. They clearly identify, and it's actually, it parallels the Australian data in a lot of ways, so we're not alone in finding this, that, you know, the natural dad is probably the safest person of all for a child to be with.
There is a lot of concealing going on around child abuse statistics. Jeremy Sammet from the Centre for Independent Studies, who we're going to have on shortly, has shown, for instance, that under the compulsory notifications, we know quite clearly the number of families that are subjects of repeat notifications and are therefore the families where the child is most at risk, and yet that data has only been released in New South Wales, and all the other states conceal it. It's just outrageous.
Look, it really doesn't, you know, I really think that this is one of those areas where government is being hypersensitive and not to the benefit of the people it's meant to serve. I think having a clear understanding of what is going on around questions of child abuse is important for everyone, not to, you know, drip feed little pieces of information that suit some particular purpose. You know, that's really not doing the children, those children who are at risk, it's not doing them any good at all. It's not helping policymakers, not helping legislators, not helping service providers to keep doing this, to, you know, conceal pieces of information.
And it shows clearly, doesn't it, that the fathers, in terms of the female and male breakdown, but also the fathers are low down in the order of males that abuse children, that is often boyfriend, and so on.
Look, I think it's one of the things that has happened too, John, where there have been gender breakdowns, like in, for instance, around child homicides, where we've found that often the term used was male parent or female parent. With female parent, this was always the natural mother, the biological mother. When they talked about the male parent, this included, you know, de factos, boyfriends, stepdads in blended families. An overnight male guest would be seen as a male parent for the purposes of those categorising. So this really did, I think, you know, hide
the figures that, against,
you know, natural dads really are, you know, if you want a child to be safe, you stick them with their natural dad. The lowest incidence proportionally of child abuse do occur in intact parents, where their, you know, their biological parents are both present. They're the families that we find, you know, much lower rates of child abuse in, and that's probably the preferred model in some ways. I'm not trying to get on a bandwagon here about, you know, family values or anything, but that does seem to be the most functional form of family formation for
all
the
right.
well-being of children.
All right, we're a bit tight for time today, but we'll get you on shortly. Again, we're going to do a whole program on child abuse with Jeremy Sammet as we talked, and we'll get you on that program if you don't mind. That would be great.
That'd be great, John. Okay.
All right, that was Dr. Michael Woods from the Men's Health and Information Resource Centre at the University of Western Sydney, a regular guest of ours and always a font of information. We'll be back shortly, and we'll be talking with Brendan Easton from New Zealand.
Empty house.
Now,
no family, no wife. I can stay up all night, I can run round in the nude. I can eat steak or any other type of food. I don't have to go and buy her flowers. Don't have to be early, I don't have to be late. I'm Daddy Immaculate. I'm Daddy Immaculate. Come through upon their yard. Daddy Immaculate, come to a Pondago. I'm Daddy Immaculate, I'm coming to a Pondago. Cause I just said her bum looks big in this. Nobody to love, nobody to care, nobody to try and tell me to cut my hair. Nobody to play with, nobody to fight, nobody to keep me warm at night.
Of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dad's in distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dad's in distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dad's on the air.
And we have on the line Benjamin Easton from New Zealand. You there, Benjamin?
Yeah, I am. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, good. Now, tell us all about it, basically. You're suing the Bank of New Zealand over the domestic violence campaign that they were conducting. First of all, can you just tell us a bit about what the campaign was and why you took such offence to it?
Sure. It was an advertisement called New Zealand's Biggest Morning Tea. It was a picture of an image of a lookalike birthday cake, and it had on it four figurines of children and four figurines of European males, all in positions of assaulting the children. A slice of the cake was animated to move from the taken out and then moved to a vacant chair, and the slogan was "Break the Cycle." So the reason why I've taken offence to it is because it's suggesting that only European fathers assault their children. That's clearly not. That's just not factual. And
oh, really? None of the Maori dads were portrayed as bashers, is that right?
No, all European. Right. One was in the image of Hitler, really. One looked a bit like Hitler.
Great.
So they really factored it in. They really made it cultural, I presume, in order not to give offence to those public that generally would take exception to that kind of thing.
Well, they all think that it's an heroic act because, you know, they're campaigning against domestic violence and they can't see anything wrong with that. So can you explain why this portrayal of men as violent abusers is so inaccurate?
Why they should be inconsistent with domestic violence or a campaign.
Mm.
The people who commit domestic violence are not just white men. And unreported is women's violence. There are no women on the cake. It's shocking that a corporate entity should take a political issue such as domestic violence and attempt to make a return out of that, to make profit, to make sales, to get customers. Have you seen the advertisement?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Can
you just describe it to us?
Yeah, sure. It's a very clear.
Right. Well, that was Benjamin Easton from New Zealand. We might just go to a short song if we've got one there, and then we'll come back, see if we can get him back on the line. It's obviously the joys of live radio. It can be a little bit difficult some days. We'll be back in a moment.
Less is to be learned.
Yes, well, apologies for the bad quality of the transmission from the mobile phone there in Auckland, New Zealand. That was unfortunate. That was a very interesting segment that we'll attempt to have that probably next week. But moving right along, there is, of course, this case going on at the moment about the footy brawl. The heading in this morning's Telegraph, Footy Brawl Dad Tells of His Trauma. Rhys Haynes has written, Footy Dad Gary Harling last night revealed the brutal details of the beating that left him horrifically injured and his two sons traumatized. The 42-year-old said he was lucky to be alive after the assault, allegedly at the hands of three fathers from a rival team, which turned into a massive brawl in front of terrified families. It erupted after Mr. Harling stepped in to break up an argument between a mother holding a 9-month-old girl and some men. Mr. Harling told the Daily Telegraph, I moved in between a mother and our team and a group of about three men who were arguing with her. I just got in between the two and said, hey, back off, to defuse it. And I looked at the woman, and the next thing I knew, I received an almighty punch across my face. Then another one straight after, I realized I was being punched by several people, and then I blacked out. The parents had just attended an under-12s rugby league game between the Harlings boys team, St. Patrick's, and Blacktown City at Murrons Oval in Glenwood on Saturday that ended in an 18-all draw. And it goes on. This is even more horrifying. His older son, James, 16, was also hurt. Mr. Harling's wife, Mandy, said James jumped on the back of one attacker shouting, get off my dad, and was pushed off and punched. I kicked the man and said, get off my son, and a woman came at me and I backed away. She would have killed me, Mrs. Harling said. Their youngest son, Oliver, 12, who witnessed the fight and almost collapsed when he went to visit his father in Westmead Hospital, he's not coping, Mrs. Harling said. He saw his father and went pale, and the nurse had to sit him down and put his head between his legs because he was shaking so much. I mean, this is just as appalling that you know, the fathers, families going to watch a rugby league game, a game between children that ended in a draw, so the teams were obviously evenly matched, should end in such a fashion with people actually being admitted to hospital. And you can see the picture here of Gary Harling with his son James in hospital. I mean, the guy looks like he's been run over by a tank. It is absolutely appalling. I mean, what's going on, people? This is a father's... What if the fathers of other children attacking other fathers? I mean, this just perpetrates the violent male sort of stereotype, which is not reflected in the domestic violence statistics, as we've heard from our last two guests on this program. It's not about domestic violence, but men in car parks do appear to be prepared to engage in physical stupidity over ridiculous things as this.
And that's exactly what it is. It's just stupidity, you know. Like, what did we put our sons into football for? Did we put them into football so they can go and biff someone else, or so we can, you know, get too emotional out in the car park? Or did we actually register our children to play football because, number one, it's good for their health? Number two, it gives mateship. Number three, you know, you learn some really good skills, you know. What did we put them in there for? And what are we showing our kids?
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous.
You know, we are supposed to be role models for our children. By behaving like that, it shows our children that, you know, it's not good behaviour. It's not good behaviour at all.
No, but these people behaving like savages. It's not that sort of behaviour. There's no place for it in a civilised society, and there's no place for it anywhere. I mean, it's unbelievable that in modern day Australia that you know, presumably educated, grown men can behave in such a disgraceful manner. And I mean, there's worse. If you go to the front page of the Daily Telegraph, the heading is "Kids Sport Parent Ban: Junior League Rocked by Bashing of Player's Father." Rhys Haynes writes, "Parents could be banned from junior rugby league games to stamp out violence, abuse, and off-field incidents." I mean, now they're talking about banning parents from even watching the games. And I mean, yep. My son plays rugby league. He played last Sunday. He scored a try. There were parents there. I mean, there was no, you know, there was nothing like that. I mean, why would you have a fight with another kid's parent? I personally, this whole issue leaves me cold. I have no idea what motivates these idiots to behave in such a stupid manner. Yeah, there's no excuse for it at all.
I also go out to sporting fields on the weekend with our kids, and you know, I've got to say, I have seen it, Ian. You know, I've seen parents get too fired up with other parents. Not only, you know, I've seen parents get fired up at the coach.
You know, we had an incident like that with my son's team. Apparently, I wasn't there, but I heard at training that one of the parents was having a go at one of the coaches and actually rolled his sleeves up and assumed the position. Yeah. You know, of attack, you know, which is absolutely uncalled for. I mean, these people just need to just back off and have a good look at themselves. I mean, if their life is so frustrating and so pathetic that they've got no other way of proving their manhood or whatever they think they're doing than to behave like a gorilla at a children's sporting match, they have a serious psychological, emotional problem. They should go and see a psychiatrist, or, you know, they should be medicated or something. I mean, this behaviour is completely and utterly unacceptable.
It is.
Well, next week we're going to have the psychologist Chris Langdon Fox on. He's done a whole series of podcasts on all sorts of different subjects, and should be a really interesting show. They're quite amazing. You can look them up on the web if you like, but we thought we would play them as well. They're right up our topic, all sorts of things: family law, everyday feminine, family terrorism, is feminism a hate movement, the wages of sin, all sorts of stuff, desperately lying about domestic violence in Australia, and there's a whole series on that, which is should be really good, and sacred cows in the China shop, give a dog a bad name about the vilification of men, and most pertinently, of course, a couple of podcasts called Stolen Generation, which is all about the removal of children from their loving dads. We'll be back next week. Don't forget, you can look at us up on www.dadsontheair.net. Our website's about to relaunch with a spectacular new design by Greg Andreessen. He's done a wonderful job. It's dadsontheair.net. And keep an eye out for the new website, which will be launching in the next few days. We'll be back next week. And thank you to our guests, who included Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency, Michael Woods from the University of Western Sydney, and Neil Humphreys, the author of a new book, Be My Baby. What an entertaining character he really was.
Yeah, he was great.
And thanks also. Lovely to see Phil York back in the land of the living.
And it's great to be back. Thank you.
And Ian Purdy.
Thank you, John. And of course, it's good to have you, John. Well, we're all here patting each other on the back.
We'll be back next week. That's dadsontheair.net.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads.